From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest on this edition of the program is Michael Barone, a leading political analyst, author, and journalist who analyzes American government and campaigns and elections. He is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, that's a think tank based in Washington, and we are coming to you from AEI headquarters in Washington. Mr. Barone is the principal co-author of the annual Almanac of American Politics. He is also a senior political analyst for the Washington Examiner newspaper. He's also the author of Shaping Our Nation, How Surges of Migration Transformed America and Its Politics, a book about which we had the pleasure of interviewing him in 2013. We'll talk with Michael Barone about his observations of President-elect Donald Trump, how he compares and differs with previous incoming presidents. We'll also ask Mr. Barone about a recent opinion piece he penned for the Wall Street Journal entitled, Which Party Truly Speaks for Elites? You might be surprised at his conclusion. Michael Barone, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you once again.
And it's great of you to host us here at AEI. Well, Michael Barone, we have a new president coming in. We'd love to get your thoughts on this rather unorthodox president-elect, Donald Trump, who many people were not sure would win the election, but in the end, he prevailed. Talk about your thoughts.
This was America's 58th presidential election that we've held at four-year intervals, going back to the 18th century, 1789. You might say that every president who's been elected is sui generis, is one of a kind. But Donald Trump seems to be especially one of a kind. He's a person who hadn't held political office before or had served in the U.S. military. Every other president has done one or the other or both. He's a person who had not been, had been an occasional commenter on public affairs and political issues, but had not been a reliable member of either political party. And so he's pretty unusual. And I think when he launched his campaign coming down the escalator at the Trump Tower on June 16, 2015, I, along with just about every other analyst of American politics, thought that this was kind of a joke, that he would never be elected, that he would fall by the wayside, that he could never win the Republican nomination. There's a political scientist book that was out in the last 4 years about presidential nominations, and it said, the party decides. People who are active in the political party. Well, of course, if the party, people who've been leaders of the Republican Party, had decided, Donald Trump wouldn't have been the nominee. He won a plurality, not a majority, of the votes cast in Republican primaries. Didn't do particularly well in the small number of states that hold caucuses rather than primaries to choose their national convention delegates. He was not the favorite to win the presidential election. I said before the election there was about a 1 out of 3 chance that Donald Trump would win. But what the result reminds us is that a 1 out of 3 chance happens 1 out of 3 times.
Well, Michael Barone, you've already delineated many ways in which he sets himself apart from other previous presidents. He has a totally different style and way of operating. How do you see him specifically setting himself apart from other recent presidents as he sets out to govern?
Well, he certainly has criticized President Obama's programs. In his rather contentious January 11th press conference in New York, he laced into the Obamacare, the sort of popular name for the Affordable Care Act, the health care legislation signed by Mr. Obama in 2010. He's attacked him on foreign policy. He also launched some very vigorous attacks on the presidency of George W. Bush. He said George W. Bush lied about weapons of mass destruction. I think that's a claim that doesn't bear inspection. I think that there's a difference between saying something that turns out not to be true and deliberately trying to mislead the American people and the world. But Trump did that. He did not have the support of the people who won 5 of the last 6 Republican nominations for presidents. But that's kind of an unusual break with usual partisan alignments, reminiscent of the 1896 election in which the Democratic nominee, the populist, William Jennings Bryan, was not supported by the incumbent president of his party, Grover Cleveland.
Well, you just used the word populist. I think that's a fair characterization of Donald Trump. And you've just stated how there are differences in the Republican Party vis-a-vis Donald Trump. Many currently still do not see eye to eye with him. But of course, there's those that did not vote for him among the Democrats. And we do note that Hillary Clinton, although she did not win the Electoral College, she still has won the popular vote by almost 3 million votes.
A plurality of the popular vote. Yes,
exactly.
That's correct. Yes, some people say majority. Neither candidate had a majority of the popular votes.
Thank you for that. Now, how important is it for Mr. Trump, in your view, to heal the political divide in the country? To what extent should he reach out to those who did not vote for him in hopes of bringing the country together?
Well, the incoming presidents usually talk about bringing the country together. President Obama did, President George W. Bush did, go back in history. When you have a two-party system, it's the dominant form of partisan politics, involves dividing people. And we have had a period of about the last 20 years in which we have had very durable, static party divisions, with each party getting approximately equal numbers of votes, and many voters just not changing their party, feeling very strongly. And I think one reason is that party identification and support of a political party is highly correlated with what I call cultural or non-economic issues, with your views on morality, with many things around which people build their lives. And that's true on both the conservative and Republican side and the liberal and Democratic side. And those are differences that have become more bitter on some cases. I think it's true to say that of the last three presidencies. And Donald Trump disrupted those party loyalties to some extent, but actually to a rather limited extent. If you look at the exit polls and the support for the different candidates, Donald Trump got slightly higher support from what we call non-white voters, black voters, African-American, people classified as Hispanic, people of Asian descent, slightly more likely to support Donald Trump than previous Republicans, but Hillary Clinton getting large majorities from each of those three groups. Among white voters, who comprise more than 70% of the electorate, Donald Trump did better among those who were not college graduates, and they provided some key votes for him, which enabled him to carry 100 electoral votes, which Barack Obama, the Democrat, had carried 4 years before. College graduate whites moved away from the Republican Party as compared to the results in 2012 in the last previous elections. They tended to vote more against Donald Trump and for Hillary Clinton than they had voted for Democratic candidates in the last several elections.
To what extent do you think he's capable of bridging the divide, of bringing those who did not vote for him closer to his view of things, or at least more tolerant? He does seem a bit vindictive in his public appearances thus far.
Well, his January 11th press conference, you could support your proposition that he was sounded vindictive, at least by some of his comments in that press conference. On his election night, when he gave a brief speech claiming victory, he was very inclusive. I'll be president of all the people. He's got some programs like his call for infrastructure spending. He says, I'm going to spend twice as much as Hillary Clinton. And you're talking about roads, about maintaining things like freight rail, about transportation, about the electric grid, which is something that is a serious issue in substantive terms, even though it's not a partisan issue. That has the capability of getting the support of some significant number of Democratic office holders and voters more than some of his other issues. But he starts off really polarizing people more than previous presidents. We are at the end now of the second period in American history of 3 8-year presidencies, two terms. Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama. The last three in a row 8-year presidencies were Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and James Monroe, who left office on March 4th, 1825. And that was called the era of good feelings, somewhat misleadingly, actually, when you read the history. We are more in an era of bad feelings now. The country can rally in a united way. We saw that after the attacks of September 11th, 2001, and I think in a very serious way. But there's these divisions that exist. The United States has always been a diverse country, and we are today. Holding this republic together is something of a hard job. We didn't succeed in doing so between 1861 and 1865 when we had a civil war. And I think Donald Trump faces probably a greater challenge, to the extent he wants to do that, than the last three presidents, each of whom faced a significant challenge in that regard.
How should minority Democrats, in your view, deal with Mr. Trump's ascendancy to the presidency? Should they only oppose, or should they look for areas of common ground? You mentioned earlier, potentially infrastructure. How do you see them?
Well, the Democrats, I think, are still kind of in the trauma ward. Looking back over my adult life, I have backed more losing presidential candidates than winning, so I have some idea of how they feel. And I think this loss was particularly traumatic for them because, as you mentioned, Hillary Clinton won a significant plurality, nearly 3 million votes, more than Donald Trump, and because just about everybody expected Hillary Clinton to win the election. And there was good reason for doing so based on the polling evidence and other criteria. She spent more money by far than the Trump campaign. They ran more television ads and so forth. She seemed to have an edge in sort of organizing voters. And yet she wasn't able to win a majority of the electoral votes. And I think it's a particular trauma for the Democrats. You hear some people on the left saying that Donald Trump is going to be another Hitler. You have the actress Meryl Streep getting up at the Golden Globe Awards, and you have one of the other speakers saying, well, this is going to be the last Hollywood award, as if Donald Trump is going to shut down Hollywood or put people in jail for saying things that are against the opinions of the president. I think those feelings are overwrought, and I think you do see some Democrats saying, look, why didn't we do better in this election? And if I was advising the Democrats, I wrote a Washington Examiner column giving them my free advice, is to look to the areas where Hillary Clinton is compared to previous Democrats lost votes. When you look at the election returns granularly by county, by precinct, you see that Hillary Clinton lost the electoral votes in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, the second congressional district of Maine, which casts a separate electoral vote from the statewide, that's 70 electoral votes. That Barack Obama won every one of those electoral votes. Donald Trump won every one of the electoral votes. Where were the votes different from 2012 when Obama was carrying those states and 2016 when Donald Trump was carrying, in most cases? The answer is it's where you get outside the major metropolitan areas, which have more than a million people, areas like Philadelphia, central Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Detroit, Milwaukee. When you get outside those areas, you see that many areas which are largely white, which tend to have more non-college graduates than college graduates, those were areas where Barack Obama was winning 44, 46, 48% of the vote in 2008, 2012. He was doing pretty well. He wasn't winning those areas, but combined with the votes in the central cities, in my minority groups, he was carrying those states. That Democratic percentage went down 6, 8, 10, 12 points in all of those, I call them outstate areas. And that was critical in Hillary Clinton losing those states. Why did they lose those votes? I think there's a number of answers there. Can they get them back? Not clear. Part of that depends on the performance of the administration, factors of world politics, and things of that nature that are beyond the capacity of Democratic politicians currently in the minority and most of the governorships, state legislatures, and both houses of Congress to affect. But I think Democrats have to look at that and say, look, we got 48% of the popular vote. Pretty good number. It's not 50. President Obama got 53% in 2008, 51% in 2012. What do we have to offer these people? I've seen some speculations from a few Democratic writers, which sound pretty smart in terms of thinking about what you need to do. Obviously, some of the things that Hillary Clinton said on the campaign trail struck these people as unfriendly. September 9th, she said, you could take half the Trump supporters are in a basket of deplorables, xenophobic, homophobic, etc. That wasn't a well-calculated statement. She said later she shouldn't have said half. It's a smaller number. You don't win people's votes by saying that they're horrible. People in these outstate areas were considering voting for Trump. They voted for him in the Republican primaries by and large. They, or people that they see shopping or going to church, voted for Obama that before. And suddenly you're being called implicitly racist for not voting for the Democratic candidate. I think it struck a lot of them as an unfriendly posture there, and I think that further Democratic candidates will want to think about that seriously.
Indeed, the Democrats would do well to heed your long-term strategic advice. You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Michael Barone. He's political analyst and resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and we are coming to you from AEI headquarters in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Musa Manaja from Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. We're back to our special guest, Michael Barone, here at the American Enterprise Institute. Michael, let's talk about how presidents communicate with the people. In the age of Twitter, this digital communications, things have changed dramatically. FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, had radio. John F. Kennedy and Reagan effectively used TV. Now Trump has Twitter and has made it a key part of his communication strategy. Are we witnessing a new era and type of presidential communication? To what extent do you think he intends to circumvent traditional media?
Well, I'm going to try to answer that in 140 characters with the last one saying news, exclamation point. Donald Trump's obviously the first person to tweet. Many people, including some Republicans, have said, gee, you shouldn't use this Twitter so much anymore, 3 a.m. Twitter. What's that about? I mean, we know that Donald Trump does not drink alcohol. He does not use drugs. So at 3 a.m., presumably he's kind of lucid, but it is late in the
evening.
And
it's not just, when he tweets, it's what he says, some of which
he's
royal markets.
He's very provocative, yeah. In the way you framed that question, you really brought out the kind of interesting fact that politicians, public figures, office holders, presidents have used different means to communicate with people. Back in 1788, there were a couple of young guys and a little older guy named Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay, who decided that they would advocate for a ratification of the Constitution by the New York legislature by publishing pamphlets anonymously. Name of Publius, they became known as the Federalist Papers, and they're some of the most profound political communication that's existed in the United States, and indeed, I think, in the world. Franklin Roosevelt comes on in 1933, becomes president, and immediately in that month, the banks are closed down in the United States. It declares a bank holiday. A month before his inauguration, the governor shut down all the banks in the state of Michigan, my home state, which was a real trauma. And Franklin Roosevelt went on the radio and said, I'm going to talk to you a little about banking. And he describes the way that deposit banks work, actually. This was a new form of communication, kind of going over the heads of the political reporters and analysts and so forth to speak directly to the people. I think that some people thought it was undignified or kind of unfair for the president to get us that way. President John Kennedy said, we'll televise our press conferences. They hadn't been televised before. Roosevelt's time, the press members gathered around the Oval Office, around the president's desk, and lobbed questions at him, and he often didn't answer them. So we do new things in each time. I think there are dangers in tweets, as there were dangers in fireside chats, but there are also opportunities, and people are going to use new media when it comes along.
A quick corollary. Are you concerned by Mr. Trump's characterization of the mainstream media as inherently dishonest when, in fact, notwithstanding mistakes that media makes, it does exist to hold people in power to account, and it is a fundamental and positive pillar, one could argue, of our democracy?
Well, Congress shall make no law restricting the freedom of the press. That's the First Amendment to the Constitution adopted in 1790. It's a pretty good idea. It doesn't say that the president can't criticize the press. And some would say that Donald Trump is criticizing the press for things, sometimes accurately, but for the same kind of thing he does himself, factual errors or misleading statements and so forth. We have a lot of debate about that. I would advise us, not a good move for Donald Trump to criticize the press so much, but you know what? he got elected president and I didn't. And I didn't think he was going to get elected president. So the established press in this country, the major newspapers, the online broadcast networks, tend to be personed by people that tend to be Democratic voters, that tend to sympathize more with the left and the right. And their work product reflects this to some greater or lesser extent. I used to say the press is reliably anti-Republican, but it is not reliably pro-Democratic. They go after Democrats, too, from time to time. And that's just one of the facts of American life that politicians, presidents have to deal with. I think there's something to be concerned about when Donald Trump goes around attacking particular companies and trying to urge them to make business decisions which they may not think are in their interest. I think that that's something that I would look askance on. We get a certain amount of that inherently just because government regulates. Government is intertwined with parts of the economic sector like the big banks, which are heavily regulated and so forth. You know, you had the Obama administration basically cutting out the Chrysler bondholders in the Chrysler bankruptcy case. There were some disturbing things there, and I think there may be some disturbing things in a Donald Trump administration. The question is, how disturbing?
You referenced his January 11th press conference, which was at times combative. Should we expect a difficult relationship between Mr. Trump and the press? Are there any historical parallels?
Should we expect the Pope to attend Mass next Sunday?
Okay.
I think the answer is yes. No president has ever been happy with the press entirely. I mean, George Washington complained about Philip Freneau's newspaper, which was secretly being subsidized by his Secretary of State, future President Thomas Jefferson. John Kennedy canceled his White House subscriptions to the New York Herald Tribune, a Republican-leaning paper, back in the 1960s. There have been lots of complaints and pressures and cross-pressures. Mr. Trump is more combative than I would advise him to be with the press, but I think it's going to be a difficult relationship. I think many people in the press think that Trump is a dangerous and potentially dictatorial character. I think those fears are overwrought, but I think there are things to be concerned about there as well.
Do you think we'll have fewer news conferences from Mr. Trump
We seem to have fewer news conference, press conferences with just about every president. I mean, Roosevelt used to gather the press around the Oval Office sometimes multiple times a week. Before Roosevelt, you weren't supposed to quote that it was the president speaking. You were supposed to refer to it indirectly. And now we've got the televised press conferences. That's more open, and then we get fewer of them.
Exactly, and of course his predilection for using Twitter. Michael Barone, Mr. Trump was swift to knock down an unsubstantiated intelligence report that Russia has compiled compromising information on him and that his campaign allegedly colluded with the Russians during the election campaign. Doesn't this add to the cloud already overhanging Mr. Trump as he prepares to take the reins of power?
Well, I think after the election result came in, a lot of Democrats said this was Russian hacked the elections. In fact, there's no evidence at all that the Russians affected the vote count and so forth. During the campaign, Donald Trump has always refused to criticize Vladimir Putin and to be critical of the Russian regime. That became an issue in the campaign. You go back and look at the debate text, Hillary Clinton said, "You're too close to Russia. You're not sufficiently skeptical about Russia." That was a substantive issue in the campaign, raised at a high level of visibility, Hillary Clinton in the debates and in other things. Voters had that information, and they had the information that the Russians had hacked the computers of some people at the Democratic National Committee, which was mildly embarrassing to them. I don't think it was the factor that turned the election around. It wasn't a help for the Democrats. People said, "Oh gosh, John Podesta said something bad. We can't possibly vote for Hillary Clinton." I don't think there are many voters that did that. I think there's attempt on some liberals to try to delegitimize Trump and say that he's a Russian puppet. I think that Trump at his January 11th press conference gave a strong and convincing argument that these allegations, which multiple news organizations have had and have not been able to substantiate and have not made public, therefore, behaving responsibly, that there's nothing to them and so forth.
I suppose we'll see. But what we do know, Mr. Barone, is that 17 U.S. intelligence agencies have concluded that Russians were behind the hacking of the DNC. And what is more disconcerting and perhaps disturbing, the dissemination of that damaging information, the emails via WikiLeaks. So you have that cloud
as he comes into office. As Trump pointed out, there's at least evidence that the Russians, if it was the Russians, and I think it was, and he has now said, perhaps reluctantly, that he thinks it was, attempted to hack the Republican National Committee things, and the Republican National Committee defenses against hacking kept them out of their machines. So,
well,
you know,
what happened was they did not leak anything from the Republicans. The leaking happened disproportionately to the detriment of the Democrats.
Yeah, we don't know that they didn't get anything from the Republicans. What they may have gotten from Republicans was so anodyne that we simply don't know the facts on that. I mean, the intelligence community estimates saying that we have with very high confidence that Vladimir Putin wanted Trump to win. Well, Winston Churchill said Russia was a riddle wrapped in an enigma and a mystery or something of that nature. I'm not sure any of us is capable of reading Vladimir Putin's mind entirely on that.
I guess what's really important for all Americans, Democrat or Republican, is that they interfered in our electoral process, full stop, period. Sowed chaos, whether it benefited the Republicans or the Democrats. So I think this is something on which most people can agree.
Well, I think there is limited effort. We prohibit foreign contributions to political candidates in this country. There's a long history of foreign governments rooting for one side or another in American elections because the United States is so important to so many other countries. And, you know, we had German-American Bund and people like that. We had the Soviet Union, the Communist Party, which was subservient to the Soviet Union, opposing President Roosevelt in 1940 and then backing him in 1944 when the U.S. was an ally of the Soviet Union. So that's a factor that people take into account. And I think in this campaign, it's not clear to me that the negative information that was leaked from the DNC, from John Podesta, was outweighed by the concern that many people have, which you point to, of saying, hey, this foreign power is interfering, which was a claim made by Hillary Clinton and by her supporters and some legitimate basis. They made that argument during the campaign. I don't think that that argument weighed very heavily, but I don't think the WikiLeaks stuff weighed very heavily with voters.
As we close, Michael Barone, back to the fact that Donald Trump is an unorthodox candidate in so many ways, the first billionaire, former reality TV star, real estate mogul, to become a commander-in-chief. Never has an incoming commander-in-chief had so many conflict of interest and foreign entanglement questions as Donald Trump. He owns large real estate and licensing businesses with holdings around the world. Now, he has said that he will not divest himself of his vast business empire, but he plans to turn over all his business operations to a trust controlled by his two oldest sons and a longtime associate. Many ethics experts on both sides of the aisle feel that this is simply not good enough, that it still exposes him to conflicts that could affect U.S. national security. He has his name on buildings around the world, how to protect them and still be the president of the United States, that this is going to cause many problems, perhaps scandals down the line. How do you see his proposal in terms of mollifying those concerns?
I think that mollifies some concerns to a considerable extent, not enough to please some people. He's essentially retaining ownership, ultimately, of his business. He says that profits from foreign exchanges, I guess, including foreign governments booking rooms at his hotels that he owns or has an interest in, is going to be donated to the U.S. Treasury. I suppose you could get accountants to see, figure out whether or not the full profits are really donated there or not. It's known that he has these interests, and I'm sure there'll be a vigorous press looking into that, a legitimate question. The first president, George Washington, actually, was one of the richest men in the original United States. He was a major landholder and land speculator, as was President Andrew Jackson. You might have argued at the time that his land speculation interests presented a situation where, as president, he could benefit them. I'm not aware that such arguments were made in 1789-97, but he did have significant interest. He didn't own any foreign hotels. He didn't have interests, perhaps foreign lenders to whom he owed money. But I think there are legitimate concerns that the press will follow up on.
Michael Barone is a political analyst and resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Well, Michael Barone, thank you so much for your time and insights as we undertake a transition of power in the United States.
Well, thank you, and it's a privilege to be on Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer and producer was Ted Schneider. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.